You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Peace, everybody. This is Joe Conzo from the birthplace of hip-hop, the Bronx, the man who took hip-hop's baby pictures, giving a shout-out to Rebel Radio and all that they do and document and continue to do. Big shout-out to Josh. Fuck you, Josh. Not once, not twice, but three times.
What's up? This is Rebel Radio.
What up? What up? This is DJ Newmark.
This is Peanut Butter Wolf.
It's your boy. It's okay.
Keep checking out Rebel Radio.
Rebel Radio.
This is Rebel Radio.
We're in the place right here. Rebel Radio is going down.
What did you say, Rebel Radio?
Oh, wait. Let's do it again.
Rebel Radio.
What's up, Rebels? Welcome back to Rebel Radio, the weekly show where I bring you the rebels who are shaping our culture. I'm your host, Josh Levine. This week, man, we have a good one for my old school hip hop heads. Joe Conzo grew up in the South Bronx, went to school with Cold Crush, and was their homie and their photographer. And he photographed the infancy of hip hop culture pretty much from the very beginning. We talk about some great old school stories, not only from hip hop, but also his father was involved in the Latin music scene with a lot of the major players there. And so there's some great music stories. And we talk about Joe's journey into hip hop, into some personal troubles. He had, I'm not going to spoil it for you, but he had a front row seat to 9/11. And we talk about all those things and how they shaped him. And it's really an amazing story of perseverance and just loving the culture and staying with it. Joe has a new book out, Born in the Bronx. Make sure you go get it. I think you can get it at One Time Run. That's 1xrun.com. A lot of his amazing photography from over the years. And let's get into the interview.
Some of these hip-hop heads, you know, barely speak English, but they can say Joe Conzo, Cold Crush Brothers, can I have your autograph? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just mind-blowing.
That's amazing. Well, cool, man. Well, I'm excited to talk to you, finally meet you. I want to talk about Born in the Bronx. I want to talk about you and your journey and all this. So if you don't mind, take me back to the very beginning. I know you grew up around music, before hip hop. First of all, do you remember the first record you ever bought for yourself?
It had to be the first record I ever bought for myself was probably a Mandrill record.
Dope.
You know, the
Dope.
Cover of, yeah, of yeah. the
with the ape on
dismorph- it. Yeah, with the ape morphing into, you know, that was probably one of my first records I ever brought. I grew up in a music household because my mother was a dancer. She graduated from performing arts high school. Mm-hmm. She was supposed to be in the traveling production of West Side Story.
Oh, wow.
But she became pregnant with me. And the joke in the family was that I ended her dancing career. And then my dad was a struggling conga player who was befriended by Tito Puente. So that became a, you know, long historical friendship.
Yeah.
For years. So, you know, I mean, I grew up listening to to Miriam Makeba, to, you know, Tito Puente, to, you know, you name it, a whole gamut of musicians. And the way I tell the story is that, you know, I was a disco head wearing bell bottom Lee jeans and things, you know, dressing up like that, big collar shirts, and being kidnapped into this culture that would become hip hop.
Do you remember?
So, you know, some of my earliest recollection of this culture in the Bronx during that time, music was playing out in the streets before it was called hip hop. You would walk on any street corner and see, you know, musicians playing congas, timbales, the guido, you know, and just playing music out in the streets in the parks. And I just happened to have gone to the high school with, you know, two guys who were forming a group called the Cold Crush Brothers. And that was EZAD and DJ Tony Tone. And prior to that, they had already been immersed in this culture. But I, you know, became a part of it because I got invited to photograph. I was the high school photographer.
Okay.
AD was the high school, you know, basketball star. And I just got invited to shoot this jam that they were doing. Mm. And the rest is history. But to me, you know, the beginning was like, you know, say 77, 78, maybe a little bit earlier than that.
Yeah.
Before Rapper's Delight. And, you know, music was just so prevalent in the Bronx and in New York City at that time.
Yeah. Talk about Cold Crush a little bit. I mean, to me, I've always thought of them as kind of the unsung heroes that, you know, we've heard the stories, there's movies made about, you know, some of the other cats, you know, Kool Herc and Grandmaster Flash. And, you know, I think there's other people whose stories have really been told, and those guys, you know, had a huge impact and influence on the culture at the time, but I don't think their story has been told as much. So I've seen you refer to them as the greatest hip hop group ever. Tell me about that for you.
I'm a little biased, but
it's okay.
You know, you got to understand the foundation of this group. You had a writer, as in Grandmaster Caz, who was doing these verses based off of, you know, Gilbert O'Sullivan, the famous, you know, songwriters, you know, and it was just so uncommon to hear these cadences in these verses, these bars, so to speak, based on, you know, I don't know, lack of better words, white, you know, songwriters, so to speak.
Sure. Yeah.
But this is what we grew up on. So good, and I'm the Lord of Rap. How fresh? So fresh that when I was young, I learned to drive women crazy with my tongue. That ass fresh. Fresh. Yeah. Well, I get wild. What makes you say that? There was no FM radio at that time. Well, maybe it just came about, but we were all growing up listening to Cousin Brucey on, you know, WABC radio, you know, and AM radio. And to have Kaz put pen to paper on these writers, it was just phenomenal, you know. And then to the harmonizing of four teenagers on a mic was just incredible. And then you throw on top and you throw in there routines. You throw in, you know, smoke machines. You throw in you know, outfits for their shows. It was a show that you went to. It wasn't, you know, four guys on a mic walking back and forth rapping as, like you see today. It was a full out production. You know what I mean? And then, you know, for them to have the foresight to A, get a photographer like me, who I would shoot their shows, run home, develop 100 8x10s. So for next week's show, we can throw out 8x10 photos.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
You know, it's just phenomenal. And then, you know, to incorporate my images on flyers that Buddy Esquire phase two were doing. This is all before the internet, this, that, and the other. You know, we'd break into the school, you know, mimeograph room. There was no Xerox machines at the time. So you would have to use a mimeograph machine, burn a stencil, make up 1,000 flyers, and pass them out. You know, they were just so ahead of their time where, you know, their reference, you know, in Jay-Z's records and TV shows like Empire and, you know, and it's sad that they never, you know, they had two record deals at the time, punk rock rap, The Weeknd, which were, you know, whack ass record deals and whack ass records, pretty much. The only real success or close to success was a Fresh Fly Wild and Bold. You know what I mean? But, you know, we're talking at a time where they were teenagers. No lawyers involved, no nothing. And just signing away their life. You know?
I think it wasn't a business at that time for most people.
No,
right?
It wasn't.
Nobody really thought that it was going to be what it is or not to even think about that stuff.
No. You know, today we're celebrating what? The 39th, 40th anniversary of Wild Styles, the movie. I have pictures of them signing the contract for the movie with Charlie Ahern.
Nice.
And if memory serves me correctly, they each would receive 50 cents divided up 60 ways. I mean, six ways for the rest of their life. You know what I mean? But, you know, kudos to Charlie Ahern, who still writes them a check every year, whether it's a couple of $100.
Sure.
You know what I mean? But like nobody knew or had the foresight that this would become a $1 billion industry.
Of course. And so, you know, so what were you thinking at the time? So you're taking photos and you're part of the group in a way, right? And now I think now our artists are like, they know that the filmmaker is essential.
Listen, you know, the photographers don't get the credit that they should get. You know what I mean? Especially the ones that documented the scene back then. I always tell people that, you know, if you love this culture so much, you know, close your eyes. What do you see? Now open them. That's what I bring to the culture, the visuals. You know, shooting back then, I was part of the band, so to speak. And I traveled with them pretty much to every jam for a span of 4 or 5 years. And, you know, again, these were just my friends that I just took pictures of.
Yeah.
I had no idea, or I had aspirations of becoming a world famous photographer and traveling and working for UPI, API, Playboy, you know, all the big magazines, just any other. Those were my dreams.
Sure.
It took 30 years for me to get discovered, so to speak. But, you know, again, you know, I was just living the moment and, you know, everything was about next Friday and next Saturday.
Right.
You know, and I had nobody was publishing, you know, pictures from that time. Nobody was giving us airplay. Even after Rapper's Delight, you know, that was a fluke that just got on the radio because of who put it out.
That's right.
Sylvia Robinson, you know, but, you know, that's when things changed. things changed. It became a commercial, and everybody strived to put that on wax. And Bobby Robinson and all these, you know, pop-up labels, and, you know, and the Cold Crush just didn't have the success as some other groups did or reap the benefits.
Sure.
But could go toe-to-toe with anybody. Toe-to-toe.
Yeah.
And their underground success is rivaled pretty much by nobody.
Yeah. And so I, you know, sometimes I think it's hard. It's easy to forget that life went by sometimes weeks, months at a time for us without being photographed. Right. And now like my I have an 11-year-old son, you know, I've been taking pictures of him almost every day of his life just because, you know, it's there. But we didn't grow up that way. Right. Like, you know, and so how do you think about that essence of like documenting a moment and a culture, and how is that different today versus when you were coming up?
Well, first and foremost, I had a love and passion for the art form of photography. I was a chubby little kid, you know, with a big Angela Davis afro. Wasn't that athletic, wasn't that, you know, gifted. You know, I didn't have the gift of gab. Wasn't a DJ or MC or, you know, a B-boy or anything like that. But I had a camera, which was a vehicle for me to break the ice, so to speak. And I walked around with a camera all the time, not knowing that I'd be documenting a genre of music, B, a moment in time in the Bronx that it was going through when the Bronx was burning, see the social activism that was going on, and D, you know, the flip side of this hip hop music was the Latin music explosion that was going on. My dad was Tito Puente's personal confidant that I got to hang on his coattail and meet all these Latin giants that I referred to as, you know, Dio and Titi, which means, you know, uncle and auntie.
Right.
And just take pictures. And if it wasn't for the support of my mother, who supported my passion in photography, we probably wouldn't be talking. She allowed me to build a darkroom in our second bathroom where I spent hours developing my skills, developing my film. I'd, you know, go buy a nickel bag of weed, you know, put on a Cold Crush Brothers tape from last week, drop it in the boom box, and just spend hours in the darkroom developing film and pictures, not knowing that I was documenting something, you know. So, again, it was the support from my family because of my love and passion. You know, I did a year and a half in School of Visual Arts, which is a fine arts college in New York City. Had to drop out because we couldn't afford it. But it was just a love and passion. And it was the support of my photography. And, you know, photographers were a dime a dozen back then. And I couldn't get a job. I had several jobs at a high school and during college, working for fine arts photographers, honing my skill with large format cameras and things of that nature. But then came the drugs, and the cameras and the equipment were sold off. And those I call my lost years.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Yeah.
But, you know, if it wasn't for my mother saving my negatives, you know, again, you know, Cornell would not have, you know, 10,000 of my negatives today that you can do research on. I probably, you know, probably wouldn't be speaking to you, like I said before, and probably wouldn't have had the journey that I've been having the last 15, 20 years.
Sure. Yeah, that's incredible. And you know, the drugs, they, you know, they come with the culture, they come with youth. They have, you know, they affect us all differently. Some people dip in and out, and some people, you know, check in and stay for a while or forever or whatever. And that's, as you said, so that's true. Part of the journey.
It's sad. You know, to me, I was always afraid of drugs because my father was a heroin addict during my younger years. Mm-hmm. And remember, you know, the trials and tribulations he went to. So I swore drugs off, but then it became a social thing of hanging out.
Sure.
You know, and it started out, you know, like any addiction, you start with the small stuff and right. you work your way up to the big stuff.
Yeah.
And when I experienced death for the very first time, that was a pain that I had never experienced. And that was the death of my grandmother, who was the matriarch of my family. And I turned to drugs. And that was, you know, a mistake. And it turned out that every time I experienced something, that's what I turned to. And next thing you know, I was homeless and, you know, selling off all my equipment and shit. But, you know, my bottom was getting arrested for the first time and spending 24 hours in central booking in jail. And when I went before the judge, I just threw up my hands and he was like, you know, you got no record or anything like that. I'm going to cut you a break and mandate you to a drug program. And I haven't looked back since. It's been 30 years.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's great to hear. So what do you turn to now when those moments of pain or loss come up?
I listen, it's funny. Somebody asked me that same question the other day. Faith. Mm-hmm. Faith, because I know, being a young 58-year-old man, that this too shall pass.
Right.
Whatever you're going through, and if it doesn't kill you, it's going to make you stronger. So I've had some ups and downs and, you know, 9/11 and cancer and all of that. And it's the faith and support of my wife and my family that gets you through it. And, you know, you will survive. You will get through it. You will get through it. It may take some time, but you will get through it. And that's what happens when, you know, when I'm throwing those little curveballs, so to speak, in life. You know, deal with it on life's term and you'll get through it.
I love hearing you say that. I mean, I think that our, you know, the obstacles, the trials and tribulations we face are, that's what make us who we are. And, you know, certainly not always fun in the moment, or maybe never fun in the moment. But, you know, I think having that perspective, right, that, you know, this is temporary and we're going to make it through.
If you want more from me and my guests, check us out over on the Stereo app. I'm doing a series of talks called Trade Secrets, where I talk to a lot of people that have been on this show. We dig into what we're doing right now in the pandemic to pivot, to create business opportunity, all that. We have, you know, we're talking about music, culture, all the stuff that we love. And what's cool about it is on Stereo, it is a social listening app. You can join in, co-host, be part of the conversation. You don't have to just listen to me run my mouth. You can listen to you run your own mouth. Join us over at stereo.com/rebelradio. We have several talks a week happening, and I hope you'll jump in.
So, you know, you mentioned 9/11. I know you were an EMT, I believe, on site at the World Trade Center. Is it? Am I right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I come from a family of activism. You know, my grandmother was affectionately known as the Hell Lady of the Bronx. My mother started the first drug rehab for women with children in the entire country.
Wow.
You know, and I needed to do something along those lines. And becoming an EMT provided me a a vehicle to help. Mm-hmm. And I tell people, being an EMT for all those years, you know, next week will be my third year anniversary of retirement, that, you know, saving lives and delivering babies, you know, how much more fun can you get out of that? and it was an amazing career. And to be an EMT or paramedic in any city in this country or anywhere, you have to be sort of an adrenaline junkie, so mm-hmm. to speak. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was fun helping grandma who fell and took her to the hospital and, you know, things of that nature. But, you know, we wanted the good jobs. Mm-hmm. The shootings, the stabbings, the people jumping off the buildings, and, you know, as crazy as it might sound, but, you know, that's sure. what it being an adrenaline junkie is. And when 9/11 happened, my partner and I had to be there. We had to be there. Yeah. And, you know, we were one of the first ambulances from the Bronx to arrive down there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just to roll the tape back for a second, you know, heading down there, it was just one plane into the World Trade Center. And after we heard on our radios that a second plane hit, the word terrorism started coming right. up. And sure. we actually thought about crashing our ambulance and not responding, because none of us had been trained for terrorism.
Right.
And, but, you know, again, being the general adrenaline junkie that we were, we went anyway. Yeah. And one of the most vivid scenes I remember was just driving down there and seeing thousands and thousands of people running the opposite way. And the only people going towards the towers were the EMTs, paramedics, firefighters, and cops. Right.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, we got there, we set up what we call a command post. Mm-hmm. And we did our job. And next thing you know, I'm in the vestibule of the Marriott Hotel, which sat in between both towers. Mm-hmm. And we hear this huge freight train roaring sound. And I ran into the Marriott to seek shelter. And my partner in chief ran back to the ambulance. And I was literally buried alive.
Oh, my God.
And literally had to dig myself out, and had no idea that the building had fallen mm-hmm. on top. We thought another plane had hit mm-hmm. and I had to find my partner, and he couldn't outrun the falling building. So he was buried under the ambulance with a broken arm, broken leg. And it was just one of those days where if you ran right, you died. If you ran sure. left, you lived.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did about almost 2 years of therapy. I had what's called survivor's guilt behind right. that.
Yeah, of course.
And what came out of therapy was that it wasn't my time to go. Mm-hmm. It wasn't my time to go. And I used the principles of recovery that I still use today to get through those moments
sure.
of faith.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that. That's an incredible story. I can't imagine what that was like to go through. I'm curious, you know, now we're 20 years later, and obviously—
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it's crazy how fast that was, right?
20 fucking years next month in September.
Yeah. So, you know, looking back from today, how did the experience change you? And again, you're a guy that captures these moments, right? You know, with the camera. So what are the moments that stay with you from that experience? And what do you think impact it's had on you since then?
First of all, to appreciate life more and appreciate each day more, so to speak. It afforded me to get back into my love and passion of photography, because up until that time, I was just sporadically taking pictures and stuff. And it was right after that that I got a phone call from Henry Chalfant, who was doing Mambo to Hip Hop, mm-hmm. and wanted to license one of my images.
The day when we went there and we battled them and Rocksteady was there, we actually was in the circle. It's called a cypher. The crowd was like this, and I was like, oh, come on, let's get in here. Gotta squeeze in, because everybody's looking. You know, when there's a battle, everybody's tight. No, no, give me some room, give me some room, hold on.
He had seen on Charlie Chase's mantle.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, license? Okay. Ma, you still have my negative?
Oh, man. Goes,
yeah. Okay, I'm coming over to get them. And it was just, you know, like, wow. You know, licensing an image, you know, for this documentary.
Yeah.
Becoming a source of income and becoming a, you know, being rediscovered, so, or being discovered, so to speak, because up until then, you know, Henry Chalfant, Martha Cooper, you know, all these, you know, Ernie Panicoli, Jamel Shabazz, mm-hmm. are people that I looked up to.
Sure.
Who were doing these books. And I'm like, you know, I can do that. You know, I have a lot of stuff that people refer to or speak about that has never been seen. And it was right after 9/11 that, you know, I got a hold of my negatives and started learning how to shoot digital, because I was still shooting rolls of film.
Mm-hmm.
Digital photography was just coming into play at the mm-hmm. time. You know, our little cell phones were, you know, I don't think they were taking pictures at the time. And, right. and if they were, they were just such a small file.
The little tiny thumbnail. Yeah.
Thumbnails and stuff. So I had to like teach myself digital photography. But, you know, 9/11 just put things into perspective for me.
Yeah.
Where I had to appreciate life even more, because it was more precious. Because, again, you know, that day, thousands of people died. And, you know, why was I still alive? So, you know, we have a saying in Spanish, no hay mal que por bien no venga. There isn't any bad that happens that good doesn't come out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the good that came out of it for me was rediscovering my love and passion for photography mm-hmm. and for the culture.
Yeah.
And appreciating life even more and family.
Yeah, that's great. So you talk about being sort of discovered after 30 years or rediscovered or whatever. So tell me about that. Like what happened and what's your response? Like how do you react as things start to happen for you?
Josh, I'm humble. I'm still can't believe that, like, even the conversation we're having today. Again, I'm just a kid from the South Bronx.
Sure.
You know, that took pictures. You know, and to have traveled the world all over, you know, to be befriended by, you know, Michael Rapaport and all these Hollywood stars, and Kate Blanchard has been to two of my shows out in London. You know, cool. How fucking dope is that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, putting out these books and stuff. It's just a humbling experience. And you know, again, you know, people knew who I were in certain circles, so mm-hmm. to speak, but those were small circles.
Right.
You know, I wasn't known
sure.
like the Martha Coopers or the Jamel Shabazzes or the Ernie Panicolis or Henry Chalfants. Mm-hmm. They knew me or heard about me and stuff. So getting to meet them after, you know, acquiring my negatives, getting my negatives back was pretty dope. And after, you know, Henry Chalfant licensing my image, and next thing you know, VH1 is calling me, MTV,
mm-hmm.
all these people. And it's just, wow, I have a body of work that predates Martha Cooper and Henry Chalfant and all these right. other people.
Yeah.
And, you know, not to begrudge, or I don't know what word I'm looking for, but Bill Adler puts it so eloquently in Jeff Chang's book, The Aesthetics of Hip Hop, saying Joe Gonzo is one of the greatest, if not the greatest, hip hop photographer, because he comes from the culture,
right,
and within the culture.
Yeah. By the way, we have Jeff Chang coming up on the show next week.
That's dope, because yeah, I'm in Jeff's new book.
Jeff's an old friend.
And Brett used my image for the new revision of Can't Stop, Won't Stop.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And nice. Yeah.
It's so dope. The circle gets smaller. That's cool. Now I forgot my question. But you talk about Bill Adler, and so what is different? And you know, respect to all those people that you mentioned. But what is different about coming from inside the culture and documenting it versus coming in from the outside?
Again, you know, it's just, I was that fly on the wall, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people would look at me back then and just, oh, that's just Joe. You know, he's right. Okay.
Right.
You know, it wasn't where I took a train from downtown to take pictures of the little blacks and Puerto Rican kids spinning on their heads or riding on the walls and things of that nature, and gaining their confidence, so to speak, to hang out with them.
Yeah.
You know, I was one of those little black and black brown kids within the culture, but, you know, just taking pictures, so to speak. So again, you know, I went to school with some of the founding fathers of the culture. And
mm-hmm.
So I had that carte blanche to walk into any jam or club or school gymnasium to take pictures, because I was down with the Cold Crush brothers, so to speak.
Right.
And, you know, it's a different perspective, so to speak.
Yeah.
Love Ernie Panicoli. He has a different style of shooting. Love Henry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't consider himself a photographer, but he's taken some dope shots. Charlie Ahern, same thing.
Yeah.
Martha, you know, Martha has a long career of being a reporter, and her style is, you know, her archives is just untouchable.
Right.
Untouchable. You yeah. know what I mean?
Sure.
But, you know, she comes from a reporting background as a, you know, a reporting photographer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a different style. Jamel's style is different, you know, and it's just, but we all complement each other. You know yeah. what I mean? Because
yeah.
we've all traveled together and exhibited together. And we're such a small, tight knit group of documentarian photographers that, you know, we'll bounce stuff off of each other. Or, you know, when we get these offers, licensing deals, you know, we'll, and, you know, the people that are trying to license my image, oh, Jeanette's on board, and Martha's mm-hmm. on board, and Jamel. Like, okay,
that's
I'll
cool.
call them up. How much are they paying you? And right. like, we'll all be in sync. You yeah. know what I mean? That's how yeah. small the circle is, because there was only a handful of us taking pictures back then.
So when you start getting those calls, right, and you start licensing, and as you mentioned, you know, kind of things start happening. Is there a game plan? Do you go think about, okay, you know, what am I going to do with this momentum? Or is it just like, you know, play it as it comes?
I play it as it comes. Again, you know, I've been blessed with a career with the New York City Fire Department
mm-hmm.
that my pension check comes in every month, regardless of any fucking pandemic or anything else that's going on. I can't imagine being a freelance photographer
yeah.
or making a career, a single career of being a photographer.
Sure.
Going through this pandemic. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Jamel, I don't know if you know this, 20 years with the New York City Correctional Department. So, you know, his pension check is coming in regardless mm-hmm. of what's going on. Mm-hmm. Ernie also retired, I think, from the communication world. But, you know, I got to give kudos to, like, Martha and all these other, you know, documentarian photographer, A, for making a living all these years.
For sure.
And surviving. So I'm humbled every time I get a request to license an image.
Yeah.
I really am, because as sarcastic or whatever word you want to use, it's gravy for me.
Right.
It's gravy.
Yeah, for sure.
And I also get to pick and choose who I charge and who I don't charge. You know what I mean? So I often donate my images for, you know, academia publications and this, that, and the other. But, you know, if you're Red Bull or MTV or VH1 and this, that, and the other, you're going to pay.
Yeah, you should.
Because I know you have the budget.
Yeah.
I know you have the budget.
Yeah, and they're using, you know, they're using the culture to sell soda or sell whatever they're selling. And you know, which is fine too, right? We've all decided that's part of the deal.
It's part of the deal. And I've learned a lot. You know, one thing I learned in this business of licensing is, like, I never knew what the word perpetuity meant.
That's a big one.
I got to get back to you on that. Let me look up this word perpetuity. And I'm like, forever? Word. No, you're not going to have the rights to this image forever.
Right.
So, you know, I've learned a lot and I continue to learn a lot, but I like being in the driver's seat where I can say yes and no.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just, you know, have control of my archives. I love the fact that Cornell came on board years ago, and at that time, it was one of the biggest checks that I had ever received. But to have my negatives sit on the same shelf as the Gettysburg Address was so fucking dope to me.
Yeah, that's
incredible. And, you know, for people to be able to research my images, to me, is priceless. Priceless. Yeah. And, you know, for my good friend, Johann Kugelberg, who opened the door to that, to make that happen, I'm so indebted to, because that collection, along with Ernie's images and other photographers and other, you know, hip hop historians, you know, Cornell has the largest body of, you know, hip hop ephemera in the world.
Is that right?
Oh yeah.
I didn't know.
Yeah.
That.
Oh yeah. And you know, to be a part of that, or to be the first to make this happen for other people, is so dope.
Yeah.
And again, you know, when I'm long gone and my family's long gone, they're going to be able to research my images.
Sure.
And that to me is just priceless.
Yeah. You know, think about that for a minute. You know, I think it's so interesting, this like academic interest in hip hop. Right. And again, you know,
I love it and hate it.
Okay.
I love and hate it. I love it that the interest is the spark is there. It's finally happening. Cornell, again, was one of the first, if not the first, Ivy League college to do this. Others have followed.
Sure.
Down south, Midwest, this, that, and the other, documenting or archiving those areas' contribution to the culture. The Smithsonian is finally getting on board. You know, I have a lot of permanent work that's on display there.
Why do you hate
it? I hate it because some of these academia professors, so to speak, who've never picked up a crate of records before or anything like that, and, you know, have PhD after their name, they think they're the go-to guru on the culture. And I'm like, wait a minute, you know, I have a PhD also. My PhD is in poverty, hunger, and determination. And I'll never forget,
that's incredible.
It was we were up in Cornell, and it was me, Kaz, Disco Wiz. I mean, you name it, the whole gamut of pioneers, Roxanne Shante. And we're at this conference, and Mark Anthony Neal, who I shouldn't mention his name, but I'll mention his name anyway, who considers himself, you know, the go-to guy in hip hop and wrote books and this, that, and the other. He's using my images as references and talking, and he is an image of Kaz, and he starts talking about Kaz. And Kaz gets up in this auditorium of about 300 people. And it's like, why are you talking about me? Like in some past tense or anything like that.
Yeah.
I'm here.
Yeah.
I can still speak about me. And, you know, I should be up there at the podium, which
That's
is so true.
Yeah.
Which is so true. You know, I was in Germany at this conference, and Trisha Rose, I think is her name, who wrote God knows how many books on hip hop. Mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm. you know, she gets up and introduces herself, and she's got a PhD, MSDW, this, that, and the other. And she's talking, and, you know, she's using these big old, you know, $20 words and this, mm-hmm, that, and the other. Mm-hmm. And the audience, mostly young kids, they're like, you know, just looking at her.
Right.
And I get up and I said, listen, I don't have a PhD. You know, my PhD is in poverty, hunger, and determination. And they went bananas.
Of course.
They went bananas.
Yeah, and, I'm not you surprised.
Know, I spoke from experience.
Right.
Not from a research point of view.
Sure.
And not to take away from academia or anything like that, but it's like, people like Grandmaster Kaz, people like Afrika Bambaataa, who was bestowed a visiting professor title for Cornell, mm-hmm. a couple of years back. They're the ones that should be speaking and teaching these classes, you know, while yeah. they're still here.
Yeah.
While they're still here. And Kaz speaks very well, and so do the majority of the pioneers. And
sure.
those are the ones that should be speaking, not these professors, so to speak.
No, I mean, look, I think you're totally right. You know, hip hop and maybe music in general, but hip hop in particular has done a really bad job of, you know, creating opportunities after the, you know, after your career as a recording artist, right? And,
yeah.
you know, you think about in professional sports, guys go on to become commentators or they work in the front office or whatever. And I think, you know, we've seen very little of that. You know, there's a couple, you know, Jay-Z went and became president of Def Jam, right? But that's rare that something like that happens. And so I think, you know, as a community, we've done a poor job of taking care of our own. And maybe that'll start to change over time. I know, you know, I saw Swizz Beatz talking about, you know, after selling Verses, he's been talking about creating, you know, income for some of the pioneers.
And that would be dope. That would be so dope. But like, you know, and I, you know, I salute Swizz for even coming up with that and some of the other big name, you know,
sure.
hip hop. But like, you know, who's a pioneer? Versus
yeah,
a legend.
Fair, of course.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, all and those... we speak about it all the time. You know, Kaz coined this phrase, a lioneer, you know, and, you know, basically, you know, okay, you were there back in 77, 78.
Right.
I saw you carrying the record crates for Flash. Doesn't make you a pioneer.
Sure.
Doesn't make you a legend either.
Of course.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what have you been doing since then and continue to do today?
Right.
And Kaz is a perfect example where was there at the beginning and still continues to do what he does best today.
Yeah.
Whether it's a Hush tour, whether it's promoting, you know, hosting the Tools of War Park Jams for 20 plus years, mm-hmm. he's still immersed in the culture. And not too many people can say that.
Well, let's give a quick shout out to Christy for bringing us together, Tools of War. Not only not only for introducing us, but for all the work she does with Tools of War, really continuing to bring the culture.
I mean, you know, Christy and Fable, who I grew up with, mm-hmm. Has done and continues to do a phenomenal job in promoting the culture, the true essence of the culture, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I was fortunate that I got to document their hard work over the years with the Tools of War Park Jams, becoming the official photographer for them in the beginning, and then opening up the doors for other photographers to document and always supporting what they do. You know what I mean? Because it was from a grassroots effort. You know, it wasn't about a paycheck or anything like that. It was supporting the pioneers and giving them a platform. And, you know, up until the pandemic, you know, people from all over the world would plan their summer vacations around these park jams.
Right.
Absolutely. And that to me is so dope. So dope.
So, you know, thinking about that and, you know, we talk about this culture and then there's modern hip hop, right? Which is, you know, which I think has become the dominant impact on mainstream, you know, consumer culture, from selling, you know, as you said, the, you know, selling soda to sneakers to, you know, creating billionaires, et cetera, et cetera. And I think, you know, in some ways it's the same culture that we come from. In some ways it's different. Right. And we have this generation gap where, you know, as we were talking about at the beginning, kids all over the world are listening to people rap and DJs and, you know, music made from 808s. But in some cases, they don't know the history. They have no interest in the history. It hasn't been brought to them. I'm not going to blame anybody.
I blame that on their parents.
That's fair.
I'll tell you why.
That's fair.
I'll tell you why. Because I was brought up in a way where I knew my culture as a Puerto Rican, Cuban, Italian. You like this music. This is how it started. You like this fashion. This is how it started. You know, that was my upbringing.
Yeah.
I love photography. I knew who Ansel Adams was and, you know, all these great photographers, Pablo Picasso, you know, dabbing into photography with his light, you know, writings and stuff. And so that's the way I was brought up. And, mm-hmm. you know, my son, I'll use as an example, could recite Young Jeezy, Lil Wayne, this, that, and the other's lyrics, but doesn't know who the hell, you know, Grandmaster Caz or the Cold Crush Brother was, you know, is. And it's just a shame. It's just a shame.
So I don't disagree with you. I'm curious, you know, understanding also things get lost over time, right? You know, generations, you know, what we were told about the stuff our parents, we got some of it, some things don't. So I guess what I wonder is for, you know, for the next generation coming up today, what do you want them to, you know, what are you hoping gets passed down?
I spoke to a group of eighth graders the other day, and like, you know, they're 13 year olds.
Yeah.
And they got a kick out of seeing my images. They got a kick out of knowing that Jay-Z spoke about the Cold Crush, who I'm showing them a picture of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the onus is on us and is as the adults in the room that to show this generation or the next generation to know the roots of whatever you're into.
Yeah.
Whether it's punk, rock, hip hop, you know, country, music, or whatever, to know the roots. And you know, you just appreciate it more when you know the humble beginnings of the roots of something that you love so much. Right. My dad always told me a story, you know, John Coltrane, you know, Tito Puente, and all these people, they were more famous overseas than they were here.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Because, you know, us as Americans, and, you know, that term ugly American, we tend to discard what's old because we want what's new.
Yeah.
And, you know, even though we created it, it becomes old in a sense and we discard it. And, you know, it's a shame that, you know, all these musicians that I just mentioned and artists also have to leave America right. to recapture or to just to be appreciated and loved more overseas, because that mentality doesn't exist over there.
Sure.
My first, Josh, my first exhibition was in London.
Oh, wow.
Because nobody, and I'm talking about the Bronx Museum, you name it, here in the States wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And after two or three exhibitions overseas, the phone was ringing off the hook to do exhibitions here in the States. Right. And I'm like, you got to wait. I'm going back overseas, you know, maybe next year or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's the God's honest truth.
Yeah.
God's honest truth.
I get it. So let's talk about the book. So Born in the Bronx. Came out, I think, what was it, 2007 originally?
07.
So tell me about why, you know, you're re-releasing it now. And I see, like, you got a lot of cool stuff. It's not just a book, right? There's a whole...
No, it's something that, you know, I was so fortunate enough to be introduced to Johan Kugelberg, a Swede that came here with $200 in his pocket in the early 90s, and was an A&R person for a few record labels, and was into punk and got into hip hop, and just started collecting, you know, rare hip hop albums. And Grandmaster Caz introduced me to him, because he asked Caz one day, by the way, did anybody take pictures back then? And Kaz was like, yeah, this guy named Joe Gonzo, Joey Kane, you know, he took some pictures, this, that, and the other. And, you know, I met him, and he was just floored. He was like, oh, these are the lost Dead Sea Scrolls. These are some of the earliest images I've seen, this, that, and the other. They should be in an exhibition, and this, that, and the other. And I'm like, yeah. Are you going to buy anything?
Right.
So... he went and put together an exhibition called Born in the Bronx, which traveled all over the world. And after it traveled for a few years, he brokered a deal with Rizzoli, and we did the book Born in the Bronx. And came out in 07. And I refer to it as a scrapbook, a family scrapbook, because everybody involved with it is a pioneer, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
From Bambada, Grandmaster Caz, LA Sunshine, Disco Wiz. I mean, you know, everybody. And that's how I wanted it to be. That's how we wanted it to be.
Yeah.
10,000 books were made. Good, successful run. We tried to get Rizzoli to reissue it. It fell on deaf ears. They went on to do other hip-hop books, because Born in the Bronx was their first hip hop book that they had ever done.
Mm-hmm.
And the rights reverted back to us. And Johan and I had spoke about it for years to re-release it, even as an ebook. But the publishing business is a hard business.
Sure it is.
It's a hard, hard business.
Yeah.
We got good money up front. I've never seen a dime on the back end of the first release, which is okay because I got to travel the world off the book.
Mm-hmm.
Gave me a new audience. And fast forward to about 2 years ago, Roger Gatzman approached me at the Beyond the Streets exhibition that I was a part of, and say, "Hey, you ever thought about re-releasing Born in the Bronx? I just saw a copy on eBay for like $600.
Oh, wow.
Wouldn't it be dope to like re-release it?" I was like, "You know what? We've been speaking about it for years, and you know, I'll get back to you." And I sat down with Johan, and he was like, "Hey, they want to run with it. Let's do it." And it was just like, okay, do we do it, just re-release it, or do we add more flavor to it? Mm-hmm. And it was adding 30 plus additional pages of photography that some people have probably never seen before. Mm-hmm. It was getting 1X Run on board and Rock the Bells. LL wrote the intro. And so far, so good. People are gravitating towards it, are loving it. And just, you know, just being able to go back down memory lane, so to speak. You know, I get emails like, "Joe, I missed the first round. I'm so sorry. I can't afford the $600 that they want on eBay, this, that, the other. I'm just so happy that this is out again, and it's expanded." And, you know, so it's been making the rounds and, you know, doing pretty well. And again, the publishing business is a hard business.
Of course.
I'm not going to be buying a mansion or buying a car off of this. Right. It's just about giving back.
Right.
About giving back and making it available again, which is, to me, priceless.
Yeah, I think so. Obviously, people want it. People want, you know, we want everything we can get from this culture, right? Those of us who've lived parts of it and want to remember, or those of us who, like you said, are from the outside looking in and want to experience it, you know, that way, it you know, it's a little bit for everybody. Also, I think, you know, I mean, I love the way you're rolling it out, because it is. You know, that's what hip hop is about, right? Is you have, you know, it's a community. And so you have Roger, who's an old friend who's been on this show and, you know, cares about bringing this culture to the world, right?
Roger's dope. Jesse Corey from 1X Run is dope.
Yeah.
Just to have LL come on board and support it also is dope. And
I see you're doing stuff with Network, you know, again, Aaron's. Yeah. Doing his thing. And so I think that's the other part of this to me is like, you know, any publisher can just dump a book out and hope that Amazon sells it, right? But but something that's coming from the community and the culture, you know, is very different. So and I think it's kind of what you were saying before is like, you know, it's just it's going with the flow. It's another piece of that keeps that momentum going, and who knows where that'll lead you next. So what is next? I'm curious, you know, what you got coming, what are you excited about next?
What is next? I'm working on Johan and I are planning on doing another book. It's a monogram, so to speak, of my work. Not only my archival work, but my current work, my digital work also.
Nice.
We plan on calling it Konzo. That's it, Konzo. And just to showcase my eye, so to speak, because I'm known for my hip hop photography, but there's so much more in terms of activism, so much more in terms of the Latin music, and then so much digital work. You know, my digital archives go back 20 plus years of shooting, you know, who's who.
Yeah.
From Jay-Z, Public Enemy, you know, to Alicia Keys, to Paul McCartney, you know, there's such a gamut. And so that's what we're working on now. And, you know, I was supposed to be in Dubai at the Contact High exhibition. I was supposed to go back to Amsterdam, but, you know, COVID put stop to a lot of the exhibitions that were planned. And, I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel.
Sure.
I'm and it's not even about staying relevant anymore. I think I'm relevant. When you open up the history books, my name will be there and stuff. But it's just sharing more of my work, so to speak.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I got to go back real quick. You mentioned, we talked about the Latin music. I know, like you said, your father was close with Tito Puente. I know you grew up around, folks like Johnny Pacheco, Charlie Palmieri.
Eddie Palmieri, the brothers. I mean, hip hop and Latin music is so intertwined.
Yeah.
Look at Sugar Hill Gang's first album. On the album cover, it says special appearance by Tito Puente.
Mm.
Tito Puente played on their first album in 1980.
I don't think I knew that.
Well, look at it. It's just so mind-boggling. What I mean? The king of Latin music playing on the first, hip-hop group, so to speak. And, my father tells me the story of Morris Levy, a famous mafia music producer back then, calls up Tito Puente and says, listen, Sylvia Robinson wants you to do a tune on this so-called hip hop thing going on. And back then, not too many people said no to Morris Levy, or Mo Levy. And my dad tells me the story, how they drove to Inglewood or New Jersey and laid down a track. And Tito was known as one take.
Mm-hmm.
Tito, he'd do most of his recordings in one take. That's how much of a genius he was. And, just to know that history, and then, Master G, 20 years, 30 years later, I have him on video talking about how he didn't know who the hell Tito Puente was because he was a 17-year-old kid. But seeing this guy, play the timbales on one of the songs was just amazing.
That's incredible.
And he would find out years later. But, that's another part of my archives that doesn't get as much attention as my hip hop archive, so to speak.
So what'd you learn from the time you spent around those guys?
Professionals. They were making records long before hip hop was making records.
Sure.
They partied a lot harder than some of the pioneers that I grew up with. You know what I mean? But constant professionals. Again, they embraced me as one of their own. That's Joe Jr. He's okay. Shooting at Madison Square Garden one day I'm at a recording session. I think D&D Studios. I'm not sure what studio it was. I'm taking pictures of Tito, rehearsing for an album and stuff. And right next door were the Village People rehearsing.
Oh, wow.
And seeing them come over to see Tito, that's how great Tito was.
Sure, yeah.
It was just amazing. And to see the Village People who were at the height of their career right next door to Tito Puente was just one of those stories you never forget.
That's so cool.
And it's just, constant professionals and, again, family.
Yeah.
Family. They're leaving us quicker than I want to.
Yeah.
Johnny Pacheco just passed away a couple of weeks ago. Eddie Palmieri's got to be 80-something years old. He's still performing. I shot him right before the pandemic. He, every time he sees me, he's like hugs and kisses and, it's just, another pioneers.
Sure.
Pioneers.
Absolutely. All right. I got to get a little lightning round before we let you go. What's your favorite city to travel to?
Amsterdam, the Netherlands. Been there like 6 times. and not for the for the openness of their drug paraphernalia and all that, but for the love.
Yeah.
For the love. There's an event that goes on out there for the past 5-6 years called Urban Matters. And they bring me out there every year.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely get hip hop in a big way. I've been out there.
Big time.
You boys on the streets and they get
and
it.
Germany too, Berlin.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Who's your favorite DJ?
You're gonna get me in trouble.
You can pick more than one.
Tony Touch, I got to give mad respect to.
Yeah.
Of course, Charlie Chase. But currently, right now, Black Coffee. I'm a house head. And just to hear his Afrocentric beats and this, that, and the other, his activism also.
Yeah.
Just Black Coffee rocks.
Yeah, you know, I had heard a little Black Coffee, wasn't really that up on him, and I stumbled into his show at Coachella, I think 3-4 years ago, and it was like it was a perfect moment. Like what he was doing was exactly what I needed to hear at that time, and
with one arm.
Yeah, incredible.
With one arm. You know, and, you know, there's honorable mentions, Oshulande, you know, a handful of others, Khan. But I'm a house head.
Nice. Love it. What's the last great book you read?
Josh, to be honest with you, I don't read that much anymore.
Yeah.
The last great book that I really read was Who Moved My Cheese?
That's a good one.
You know the book?
Yeah, I know it, and they had a kids version when my kid was young. I used to read it to him over and over. It's a good book.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, I come from a union labor background. I was the vice president of my union before I retired, and you know, my good friend Pat, who was the president at the time, gave us all this book, Who Moved Our Cheese, and I'm like, wow. It just reinforced
Yeah, and sometimes we need to hear those lessons over and over, or in different ways, for sure.
Yeah.
What movie do you think you've watched the most in your life?
West Side Story. West Side Story. It just, the connection to my mother, the connection to growing up in a time where gangs were prevalent, the decadence, the decay around. I cry all the time. You know what I mean? Yeah. I really do.
Yeah.
It's a great movie.
Who's somebody that you've learned a lot from that you haven't met?
I can't answer that. Pretty much, I've been fortunate to meet a lot of people, whether it's just in passing, a handshake, an embrace that I've learned a lot from. You know, Michael Rappaport, as crazy as that motherfucker is, you know, he doesn't hold back. You know what I mean? And, you know, Swiss Beats, who I've had the honor to meet on several occasions, who appreciates my work.
Mm-hmm.
What he's doing in the art world besides the music world is just phenomenal. And so, you know, I've met everybody that I've learned from.
That's a good problem to have.
Yeah.
Okay, last question. If I was on your team or we worked together, what's something I would hear you say over and over?
I'm Joe Conzo. Let me take pictures. Leave me the fuck alone. Why? Because in today's world of music and photography, photographers are treated like cattle.
Sure.
We're allowed to shoot the first two songs of an act. We're shuffled off to the side so the act can finish.
Right.
And we're shuffled back in to shoot the first two songs of whatever the next act. I don't shoot that way. I don't shoot that way. If I can't shoot the way I shoot, I won't shoot your event. Perfect example was Rock the Bells. They had a long run of, I think, 6, 7, 8 years from mm-hmm. coast to coast of mm-hmm. putting on, you know, Rakim, Public Enemy, Wu-Tang, you name it. And they didn't know who the fuck I was. It was Chuck D that had to tell the promoters, like, that's fucking Joe Conzo. He gets a leave him alone pass, walk wherever the fuck he wants pass.
Yeah.
And I promise you, you won't even know he's there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, if you were on my team, you would hear me say when I shoot events or anything.
Yeah.
Just leave me alone.
Mm-hmm.
One, I know how to respect who I'm shooting, because if you don't want your picture taken, I'm not going to take your picture.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Two, I know how to shoot the picture and get out the way. I won't become part of the act as you see other photographers up on stage all in front of the artist. I'm like, yo, you're not part of the act.
Right.
You know what I mean? If yeah. you can't shoot from wherever and not obstruct the show that's going on, you're not a photographer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to shoot differently than everybody else. It's not about just the act. It's about what goes on before the act and after the act. So, perfect example, Chuck D, who I love to death, who respects me so much, you know, seeing Chuck D warm up before going on a crowd of 30,000 people, doing jumping jacks behind the stage and stretching and drinking water and things of that nature,
yeah.
you know, just getting in the right mindset.
Sure.
Because his act is so physical, mm-hmm. you know, moments like that, you don't see.
Right.
And, you know, I want my images to stand apart from the 100 photographers that are in the pit.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah. if I can't shoot the way I want to shoot, I'm not going to shoot your event. You're not going to be in my next book, or you're not going to be in my archives. Period. End of story.
I love it. Well, that's a great yeah. way to finish, man. I appreciate you.
No, Josh, thank you for all that you do. Continue doing. I'm so glad that we connected with Christie's email blast. And
yeah, absolutely. Well, let's keep in touch. Hopefully we'll meet up in person one of these days.
Yes.
And,
yes.
When, you know, I'll travel again. Dude. And you know, everybody go get the book. Follow you. Where should people follow you on social media or online, whatever?
All the social platforms, joeconzo.com, my website, type in Joe Conzo.
Right.
And yeah, yeah, support. Support right. local artists.
Right on. Thanks.
Yeah, that was Joe Conzo on Rebel Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. Make sure you go get a copy of Joe's book, Born in the Bronx, at 1xrun.com. And leave us a comment. Tell us what you thought about this one. Hit us up on Twitter or Facebook at Rebel Radio Net. You can find videos of a lot of our interviews on our YouTube page. And most importantly, come back next week for more Rebel Radio. If you like these talks, you can get more at the Stereo app. And you can even join in our live social conversations. Talk directly with me or my guests. Ask questions. Share your perspective, you know, tell us what you think, all that. Download it now and join us live this coming week. Stereo.com/Rebel Radio Net.